All right. So in many ways, the target audience and the specific person intended to gain the most from this share series is me. And I've already heard it and I enjoyed it a lot. But basically, this entire series is born from, problem is too grand a word and it's the wrong word, but born from an issue I had actually several years ago, which was that I did not know how halacha functioned. And we talk about, we talk about these texts. We throw out all of these texts the entire time. You have the Mishnah, you have the Gemara, you have the Shulchan Aruch, but they are products of a certain point in history, and they are products of either certain people or certain groups of people. And they often have certain clear methodologies, or at least clear rationales behind why they were written, why they were made, and I realized I knew none of it. And so several years ago, I set out to create a Shir series for when I was originally the rabbinic intern, and then I gave it again when I was the rabbi in Boston, and which I called How a Mishnah Becomes a Law, and which basically traced the development of halachic history. And we have the beginning of the rabbinic movement called around the turn of the Common Era, through to, you know, the 20th, 21st century, and we have all of these texts, and we have all of these ways of understanding how Jewish law comes to be, and I set out to try and trace that. The Shir was good and successful and enjoyed. What I basically realized, though, was it's not enough to cram all of that into a 3 or 4 part series, and that there was so much, and I was left myself with so many questions, that what I've decided to do instead is create what I'm calling, for want of a better expression, like an awe series, this kind of ultimate series called Defining Eras of Jewish History, of which this 3 part series is the first part of that, which will basically take a look at, well, the defining era of Jewish history, the defining texts, the defining moments that made Judaism, Judaism. So my goal is this 3 part series, we will talk about the Mishnah, the birth of the rabbis, the Tannaitic period, which I will explain a bit more about shortly. Another series will please God focus on kind of the Gemara, the Talmud, how that came to be. We have the period of the Gaonim, which is one of the most fascinating periods. It's the period after the close of the Talmud. Eventually we'll get to, you know, medieval times, where I'll have to rethink how to do everything because it's not as easy to talk about then. But basically my goal is to spend the next 3 weeks, Shir series, is focusing on a very, very narrow point in Jewish history, but also the most significant and defining. And it's what we call the Tannaitic era, the era of the Tannaim. These were the rabbis of the Mishnah. We won't actually be talking about the Mishnah really tonight so much. We'll get to that at another time. But it's roughly 0 through 200 CE, which is obviously too clean a date range to be real, but it's a good date range nonetheless to work with. It's good enough for our purposes. And what I want to focus on tonight is recognizing and realizing that these Tannaim are actually the first rabbis. And what happened at basically the turn of the Common Era, or really a little after that, was the birth of the rabbinic movement. And so what I want to talk about tonight is this, the beginning of rabbis, the birth of the rabbinic movement. While we call ourselves nowadays Orthodox Jews, a far better term would be rabbinic Jews. And we live a Judaism defined by the rabbis. The rabbis going back through history, we don't appreciate this so much nowadays because we don't really know of those who opposed the rabbis. And that's what we're going to talk about also tonight. But to understand, in a sense, the birth of the Judaism we live, we have to understand how these rabbis came to be. How did the rabbinic movement begin? And so that's what we're going to talk about. But there's a problem. There's a problem with trying to understand the birth of the rabbinic movement. And I came up with what I think is a clever name for it. I call it the Founding Fathers problem. And so, look, American history is not my jam, but I'm still pretty confident what I'm going to say is true. It's this. The Founding Fathers of America knew they were creating something, but the reason their creative act is significant is because we are living in America in the 21st century. Contrast them with Oliver Cromwell. Within 10 years of him lopping the head of Charles I, Charles II sat on the throne. He's a footnote to history. And so what I'm trying to get at is the founders of any movement, the founders of anything, are only significant in retrospect. What makes, you know, the founders of something become significant is the thing they create ends up gaining momentum, ends up gaining significance, ends up defining future things. Think of all the countries that have been created throughout the last several hundred years. And if they didn't end up lasting very long, or their ideas didn't end up lasting very long, those people end up being relegated to history. So the first issue, the Founding Fathers' problem, is we think nowadays of people like George Washington as immensely significant figures. But part of the reason they are immensely significant figures is because we're now however many hundreds of years after they created America. Random person X who created random country Y is not significant because random country Y no longer exists. That's the first problem. The second problem that relates to this, and this is another important thing to just bear in mind, we say George Washington was the first president, but the institution, the office of the US presidency, whatever that exactly is in the 21st century, is not what it was back then. America was not a global superpower, obviously, all of these various things. But nonetheless, we imbue George Washington. We imbue the early presidents with the office, the significance of modern presidents. And that can also be a problem. So when we think about the birth of the rabbinic movement, there are two things to bear in mind. We retroactively, aggrandize the fact that they were rabbis, when obviously they were rabbis, they were deeply influential rabbis, they ultimately, you know, set us on course for the Judaism, on course for the Judaism we live today. But we shouldn't confuse that with thinking they were like the rabbis of maybe the greatest periods of Jewish history. They had the significance. They had the audience. And the second problem is, the second thing to remember is that these early rabbis did not necessarily know they were creating rabbinic Judaism. So we look at them nowadays, we look at people like Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the one who basically, you know, edited, you know, came up with the Mishnah. We think of his act as immensely significant because it is, but at the time, you know, it might not have happened. There were definitely, and we'll talk about this in other weeks, there were competing versions of the Mishnah that never took off, written by rabbis we don't really remember. And that's what we'll talk about, you know, the next 2 weeks. So it's just really important to bear in mind from the beginning that when we think about the origins of anything, we should never kind of retroactively ascribe our own impressions, our own feelings about how we understand it now back on its origins. And so what I want to begin with the source sheet, is a very well-known source, which is the Mishnayot. Hopefully everyone can see the source sheet. The Mishnayot at the beginning of Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. And we, generally speaking, Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, is one of the most influential of all Jewish works. And it's one of the most significant. And what we love about it is it has a lot of ethical statements. It has a lot of good ideas, good kind of aphorisms. You can put on a magnet and stick on your fridge to be inspired by if you're that kind of person. I don't actually have any, but I'm sure someone could do that. And basically what Pirkei Avot does is it goes through the major rabbis of each and every generation and tells you what they were best known for. Like, think about any major rabbi or public figure that you know. Among all of the various things that they are known for, there is like one catchphrase. There is one thing they harp on about more than most. Pirkei Avot is basically that. That's what we focus on. These are the statements the rabbis were best known for saying. But what's equally important for Pirkei Avot is that it traces the transmission of Torah Sheba'al Peh. It delineates how the oral law came to be in the hands of the rabbis. But when you ignore all of the various statements, which you'll see from the ellipses, and we're going to read it in a second, something significant starts to emerge. Several things of significance start to emerge. And I wanna look at it now. Source number one. Moshe kibel Torah mi Sinai. Moshe received the Torah from Har Sinai. Umasara li Yehoshua, he gave it to Yehoshua, Yehoshua le Zakenim, Zakenim le Neviim, Unaviim asua le Anshe Knesset Hagdola. Those first three lines are basically going over, glossing over the era of Tanakh, the biblical era. And it's chained from Moshe to Yehoshua to prophets, elders to prophets, and then to the men of the great assembly. And then we read, Shimon HaTzadik, he was basically the last guy left who had received it from the Zakenim, from the elders. And we get his statement that he was known for, unimportant for us. Antigonos ish socho, kibel mishimon hatzadik. And then we learn who got it next. A guy called Antigonos. Antigonos is a fascinating person in history for a couple of reasons. This is during the Hellenistic period. And it's not Hanukkah, so now's not the time to dwell on this at any length. But for all that we often, and I've talked about this before, we portray Hanukkah as kind of Greeks bad, Jews good. Remember that one of the most important men in rabbinic history was called Antigonos, which is, spoiler alert, not a Jewish name. Antigonos is about as Hellenistic Greek as you can come. Nonetheless, okay, he was a major person. He received it, kibel mi, Shimon HaTzadik. And then we start getting into pairs. This is another moment in rabbinic history where you get pairs of figures. And we read Yosef ben Yoezer ish Tzreda, the Yosef ben Yochanan ish Yerushalayim kiblu mehem. These guys received it. Yoshua ben Parachia v'nitai ha'arbeli kiblu mehem. Yehuda ben Tabai v'Shimon ben Shetach kiblu mehem. Shmaya v'Avtalion kiblu mehem. And then Hillel v'Shamai, the final words of this first paragraph. Hillel v'Shamai kiblu mehem. Hillel and Shamai, some of the best known figures of Jewish history, they were the final pair. So it's just important to note, in this first paragraph, it's very obvious that someone is taking Torah and giving it to someone else. That person is receiving it from the previous generation. Now, the ellipse, what follows actually this paragraph are several Mishnayot of Hillel and Shammai's famous statements, because they were so well known, there's a lot of them, and we get distracted by the fact of what follows next. One other thing I just want to draw your attention to is, note, everyone here is basically on a first name terms only. No one has titles. It's Antigonos, it's Yosei, it's Yehoshua, it's Yehuda, Nitai, Shimon, Shmaya, Avtalion, Hillel, Vishamai. No titles, no nothing, first names only. The very next Mishnah, which picks up the chain, continues with Rabban Gamliel. Rabbi Rabban Gamliel would say the following, and actually kept his lines in there, his famous phrase in there, because it's very significant. Asei lecha rav, make for yourself a rav. And the histolic min hasafik, avoid doubt. The al tarabe la'aser omadot, and don't guess your tithing. And then we continue, we have Shimon Beno, his son. And then again, Rabban Shimon Ben Gamliel. And then finally, Rabbi Omer. Rabbi is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the editor, the guy who basically created the Mishnah. Several things to note. First is the now emergence of the title Rabbi, Rabbi. In some form or another, Rabban, Rav, Rabbi, Rebbe. It's Rabbi conjugated 15,000 different ways. And this is basically true of most of Jewish history after this point. Most Jewish figures who are, it's almost total, who are rabbis are called rabbi. But the main figures of Judaism from this point on will get the title rabbi. Now, that's not completely true. There are some famous rabbis in the Gemara, like Shmuel and Abaye, who don't get titles, but they are always paired with someone else. There is Rav. And Rava is a contraction of Rav Ava. So even if some people don't always have the title Rabbi, almost everyone does. Rabbi seems to start at this moment here, Mishnah 16. Second thing and more significant, Rabban Gamliel doesn't receive it from anyone. It does not say, you would think it should say, after saying Hillel and Shammai received it from Shmaya v'Avtalion, Rabban Gamliel, Kibel Mayhem. He received it from them, and he would say the following. Nope. We just pick up with Rabban Gamliel out of nowhere. Boom. And so what's very clear, or what I'm arguing is very clear, is that there is an inflection point at this point in history between Hillel and Shammai, their generation, and Rabban Gamliel. There is something happening. Something significant is happening that, in some sense, severs this chain of transmission, and at the same time creates all of these people with the title rabbi. And that's, it's the birth of the rabbis. That's what we're going to talk about. That's what I want to get to the bottom of. What happened at this point where we go from Hillel and Shammai to Rabban Gamliel, where we go from everyone receiving it from someone else to seemingly it all starting once again from someone else. And it's also important to just once again, the statements, what was Rabban Gamliel known for? So first is Ase Lecha Rav, make for yourself a rabbi. This is a classic. How many, you know, Divrei Torah start with the importance of making for yourself a rabbi, that we completely forget the significance of this, which is Rabban Gamliel is one of the first rabbis. He's not saying have the way we usually interpret this, which is true, but nonetheless, the true point is you should have a rabbi you go to ask questions and don't kind of shop around. But the point here is he's stating the importance of rabbis. Second, avoid doubt. It's a legal thing, which is something obvious, but nonetheless, rabbis are going to get very into legal weeds where doubts can emerge, and you don't want to create doubts in legal systems. That is bad. And finally, an obsession with tithing. Lock that away. Bear that in mind. Rabban Gamliel was obsessed with tithing, with ma'aser, with this idea of being very precise in how you tithe. And so what I want to talk about tonight, the birth of the rabbinic movement, but what's really important, if it's not been clear already, is we need to deprogram ourselves. Because we instinctively associate the term rabbi, I've been struggling to avoid it myself, with major Jewish learner, major Jewish leader, major Jewish figure. We call Moshe Rabbeinu, our rabbi, really it's our teacher. And when we look at Hillel and Shammai, you would say, what were Hillel and Shammai? They were rabbis, which is both true, but also not. Because think of rabbi for the rest of tonight as a brand name. It's a very specific thing that connotes a very specific type of person who belongs to the rabbinic movement, which we'll talk about. What we call the Mishnah and Gemara, the generic term for that is rabbinic literature. Rabbis produced rabbinic literature. And so, going back to my kind of American history, I Wikipedia'd this. I had a hunch and I was right. Some people claim that a guy called John Hanson should be considered the first president of the United States because he was basically in charge of whatever was the United States just before George Washington. But he wasn't the first president, because president means leader, but it's also a brand name. President of the United States is a brand name that can only by definition apply to the president of the United States. The leader of the country before it, you know, registered the brand name, might have had all of the power, might have had all of the office, might have had all of the same associations as George Washington, doesn't get the brand. Hillel and Shammai weren't rabbis. They might have looked like rabbis, talked like rabbis. They were, for all intents and purposes, rabbis, except they didn't have the brand name. They don't have that official participation in the rabbinic movement. Hillel and Shammai, between Hillel and Shammai and Rabban Gamliel, is the dividing line. That's the moment between rabbis and pre-rabbis. So what were Hillel and Shammai? The answer is actually simple, and it's a word where probably many people are very familiar with, but actually understanding what it means is going to be the key to understanding the birth of the rabbis. They were Prussian. They were Pharisees, which is a term we are broadly familiar with as being one of the sects during the Second Temple period. But what exactly it means, we really need to get a better understanding of. In a nutshell, during the Second Temple period, while the Beit HaMikdash was in control, we're talking the Roman period. I mean, it was earlier than the Roman, but really the Roman period is probably a good time to start thinking about this kind of thing. There were lots of different Jews with lots of different visions about how Judaism should look. And we have the Prussian, the Pharisees. We have the Stoican, the Sadducees. You have the Essenes. You have the early Christians. You have more, it's Jews. So of course there are more sects than you could possibly imagine, because, you know, think of how easily Jews break away from everything nowadays. And it was twice as bad back then. There were just lots and lots and lots of competing visions for what Judaism should look like. And the truth is, this comes up in a lot of Second Temple literature. And take the Mishnah in Yadayim, source number 2. Omrim Tzedokim, the Sadducees say, Kovlin anu aleichem, we are angry with you, Perushim, Pharisees. She'atem Omrim, because you say, Kitvei HaKodesh mitam im et hayadayim. Holy scrolls, like think of Torah scrolls or other scrolls upon which holy texts have been written, and will defile your hands. They will make them tame if you touch them. They will make them ritually impure. Visifre Homeris, but the Homeric works, enoma tame et yadayim, don't defile your hands. This Mishnah is cool because A, it mentions the Homeric works, which is just fun to know. But really, that we already get a huge fault line between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, Tumah and Tahara, purity and impurity. Nowadays, again, we're Western Jews, we're Western people, we don't really have concepts of purity and impurity so much in our wider lives, but a major focus of basically every non-Western person in human history has been this. The Pharisees and Sadducees debated and fought over this very question of Tumah and Tahara. This was a major question. It's just worth pointing out the reason the Sadducees can't understand how Homer is basically completely okay to touch and imparts no problem, whereas like touching a Sefer Torah will make your hands kind of unclean. It seems backwards. The answer is you are really, really careful about touching things and if they're going to render you impure. And the more you touch something, the more likely you are to damage it. Even to this day, we are incredibly careful about touching Sifrei Torah, because the truth is they are very fragile. Parchment is easily, a lot of things can go wrong very easily. So this whole idea here is to basically protect holy works. But most significant is the fact that there is a fault line between the Prushim and the Tzedokim. We get another sect named, in source number 3, the Gemara in Eruvin. Vahatanya, Hadar im Hanochri, Saduki uvaitosi. If you live in the same alleyway with a non-Jew, a Sadducee, or a Bothesian, whatever they were, but it's another sect, again, lots and lots of competing visions for how Judaism should look. Hare Elu Osrin Alav, you can't use the Eruv you have created. Essentially, the Eruv is if someone does not agree to the Eruv, then you have a problem. So what it's basically saying here, it's actually a very fascinating statement. What it's basically telling us is that these other sects cannot be trusted halachically. We cannot see them as imparting a validity upon the things we have created. Essentially because Sadducees do not like the concept of an Eruv. They are anti-Eruv. There is even modern day questions about what you do about people who are intentionally committed to the invalidity of the Eruv. Not a question I want to get into now. But the other important thing to extract from here, they live with each other. And this is the other component to realize about sectarianism in Second Temple times. On the one hand, you completely disagree about everything with one another, and yet at the same time, it's your next door neighbor. Imagine, I mean, you know, this is like, you know, several months ago now, you would have seen, you know, your neighbors might have had signs on their lawn, which, you know, completely conflicted with your most, you know, crucially held viewpoints, and that angered you. Imagine that not lasting however long that lasted, that lasting your entire lifetime, and you are fighting over the very fabric of your religious identity. It's even worse, it's even more tense, it's even more, you know, difficult. But it's important to realize they disagree with each other about everything, but live next door to one another. There's also references to these various sects in other Second Temple literature. One of the most important figures for all of this is Josephus. It's important to always bear in mind two things about Josephus at the same time. Number one, take everything he says with a huge grain of salt, because he wasn't apologetic. He was trying to make the Romans, you know, respect and like Jews and understand Jews. But at the same time, number two, he's basically all we have. So most people, like historians, will read Josephus and be like, on the one hand, this seems difficult, but on the other hand, we have nothing else to either corroborate or challenge it. So he's probably broadly speaking right. And Josephus explains, source number four, for there are three philosophical sects among the Jews, the followers of the first of which are the Pharisees, of the second and the Sadducees, and the third sect, which pretends to a severer discipline, are called the Essenes. And he actually goes on to describe at length the characteristics of each of these movements. The Essenes, by the way, are the people who give us the Dead Sea Scrolls. Basically, the Essenes broke away. They didn't think anyone else was firm enough for them. They were very strict. They really, really amplified this idea of Tuma and Tahara, of lightness and dark and a lot of other things. So basically they fled to caves in the desert where they kept their scrolls. I spoke about before we learned Megillat Esther. It's the one scroll we don't have from the Essenes, which points to one of two things. Either someone forgot to copy it, which is possible, or we just don't have a copy of it, or they didn't like Megillat Esther, because, well, someone else was able to write on the share screen, which I did not know was a power, but we just have a giant, someone is trying to strike the Mishnah from the source sheet. Wait till one of the sources comes up, and then people might really start to try and, I'm like intentionally trying not to reveal the sources, because we're going to come up to an interesting source scene for a shear, but we'll get there in a second. The Essenes might also not have kept Megillat Esther, because they didn't, they didn't like it, because Esther's living with essentially a non-Jew and all those other things that we talked about. But basically, the Essenes were another sect. Why did they leave? Ultimately, they thought the Beit HaMikdash was corrupt. They did not agree with the way the temple was run in its period. And so they loved, and it's really important to understand based on what I'm about to say, all of these sects love the Beit HaMikdash as a notion, but a lot of them hate it as an institution. The Essenes broke away because it was corrupt. The early Christians, later Christians will go on to say, you know, Jesus became the temple, yada, yada, yada. The early Christians loved the temple. The Christian Bible is kind of, if you were making a play of the Christian Bible, which I'm sure someone has done, most of it is set in the Second Temple because they were there. They were Jews who were attending the Second Temple. They also broke away because it was corrupt. The Tzedokim, the Sadducees, are the Kohanim. They are the priests of the temple. And it's important to note straight off the bat, not every Kohen was a Sadducee, but there is a strong correlation between the two. They controlled the temple. They liked things the way they were. They were very pro everything in the Beit HaMikdash. They did not think it was corrupt because, well, if you're the person doing the corruption, you don't think anything's corrupt. They're happy with it. The Perushim, the Pharisees, also very much dislike the way the Beit HaMikdash is run. And another major feature of Pharisaic life, of Perushi life, is to believe that the sanctity of the temple extends into your wider life. Hence why Pharisees were obsessed with purity and impurity beyond the confines of the temple. The idea of being in a state of ritual purity is, broadly speaking, a concern for the temple, but not for Pharisees. Pharisees extended it. It governed your wider life. To be a Pharisee, to be a Purushi, is the word poresh. It's to separate, to be a separatist. You separate yourself. Who are they separating themselves from? The Amei Haaretz, Amei Haaretz nowadays, and it's clear the way Chazal use it, it means ignoramus, but it really just means like the general population. They separated themselves from the general population, whom they did not believe to be trustworthy in matters of ritual purity and impurity. Another thing that they were obsessed over, Ma'aser, tithing, which again is a temple-centric concept. I already mentioned this, but again, the idea of tithing became a very important one for Perushim. There is a question raised about how much they called themselves Perushim versus they were called by others Perushim, because it can sound a bit like a pejorative. Often that's how these things happen. Pejoratives end up being adopted by people as their defining name later on. But there you go. There are other sources that really help us understand sectarianism in its fullest. And they are strange sources to put on a sheer source sheet, but they are Christian sources. First of all, I'll just say this. We don't realize how valuable the Christian Bible is and Christian sources are for helping us understand Jewish life in the Second Temple period. Most of the things, you know, and we're going to talk about this more next week, and I'm basically going to open next week with this, so I'll say it very briefly now. Often we think rabbis invented stuff because the first evidence we have for a given practice is, say, a Mishnah. Yet if you read the Christian Bible, it's clear Jews were doing it before the Mishnah was written. The Haftarah, we know it was done in Second Temple period times because Jesus does one. If you try and find a source, and I think I've definitely mentioned this before because it's one of my favorite things to point out, so I'll mention it every opportunity, the custom to name a baby boy at his Brit Milah. If you try to find a Jewish source for Jews doing that, like not Avraham, like Jews doing that, it's really hard to find. It's like medieval. Christian Bible talks about it. It's a great place to mine for evidence of Jewish life in the Second Temple period. And so this first source here from Justin just helps us capture the one side of the sectarianism. They all hate each other. He says, do not imagine that they are Christians even as one, if he would rightly consider it, would not admit that the Sadducees or similar sects of Janisti, Maristi, Galileans, Hellenists, Pharisees, Baptists are Jews. Interesting, a lot of people question the inclusion of Pharisees there, but basically what he's saying here is all of these various groups don't consider each other Jews, which is the first side of the coin of sectarianism. They all hate each other. Every single group that claims to be the sect of Judaism thinks the other are completely and utterly wrong. But there's an even better source for this, the book of Luke. Source number 6. Strange source to read, but an incredible source for so many reasons. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. How do we know Jews were doing Netilat Yadayim in the Second Temple period, despite the fact that the Torah doesn't mention it? Because, well, Jesus didn't, but Pharisees did. Washing before a meal, this is one of the earliest pieces of historical evidence we have that this is something Jews do. It's earlier than the Mishnah, which starts to talk about it. It's earlier than the Sugyot in the Gemara, which talk about it. This is one of the earliest references to washing. I actually decapitalized the word Lord, but Jesus says to him, now then, you Pharisee, clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But now as for what is inside you, be generous to the poor and everything will be clean for you. Woe to you Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. A few things to note here. First of all, this is a polemic, if you hadn't guessed. But the obsession with tithing. So again, it's a polemic. So he's being overtly critical of the Pharisaic obsession to do ma'aseh, to tithe. But nonetheless, that's what they were known for. They were known for their obsession with tithing and for ritual purity, netilat yadayim. That's what Jesus is getting annoyed at this random Pharisee for. But there's something else that's really, really important to come from this source. Jesus, who is definitely not a Pharisee, is eating a meal with a Pharisee. And this is something, he was invited to a meal. And this is the other side of the coin of sectarianism. They hated each other. And they had disagreements about the most fundamental of issues, but they still kind of all ate it. They kind of got along. They kind of recognized each other as Jews. They kind of recognized that the fierce debate only went so far. And the best analogy I can think of with this, it's somewhat of a controversial analogy. I'm not intending to go the controversial route. But imagine the following. As we know, there is a small percentage of the Chabad movement, which is messianic. It believes the Lubavitch Rebbe was the Mashiach, is the Mashiach. Yair once went to a camp in Boston. It was a Chabad camp. And on the I didn't like the camp for a lot of reasons. And then on the final day, there was an event all the parents were invited to in the shul. And I saw on the shul of this Chabad, on the wall of this Chabad shul was a giant sign, Yechi HaMelech HaMoshiach Adonenu, I think they even went as far as to say, recognizing the Lubavitch Rebbe as their Mashiach. Just generally, to just know in terms of the catchphrase, Yechi HaMelech HaMoshiach marks a general messianist. Adonenu, our Lord, is really creepy because they're starting to kind of like combine God with the Rebbe. And then there are some who even add Uvarenu, our creator, who go the whole hog. So imagine if the most extreme, it's a minority within Chabad, but imagine if the most extreme of the messianists within Chabad took over the Chabad movement 100 years from now, 150 years from now. So much so that it basically becomes its own religion. And now someone is looking back at history and cannot understand how in the 21st century, in the 20th century, Orthodox Jews and Chabadnikim would daven in the same shuls. They'd go to each other's houses for meal. You know, they'd sometimes split their time between the shuls. How could this be? The answer is because in 2021, it's the same religion that the same Jews, quite frankly, we don't know who's messianic anyway, but it's the same religion. In the Second Temple period, there was a certain level of Jews being Jews. And at the same time, on the flip side, tremendous debates about what this Judaism would look like. They recognized their broad shared identity to the extent that clearly they were eating meals with one another, but at the same time, nonetheless had these incredibly fierce debates. The fundamental source of those debates is the Beit HaMikdash and what it should look like. Whether it's corrupt, whether it's not right, whether it's problematic, and a whole set of different things in between. But the ultimate, issue surrounded the Beit HaMikdash. So if I just scroll up for a second, back to source number one. The inflection point between the first paragraph and the second paragraph, between Hillel and Shammai and Rabban Gamliel. What happens between these two generations? A really defining moment. The Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. And when the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, that does not end sectarianism, but it really, really, really pulls the rug out from under sectarian debate. you can't really fight with a Sadducee about whether or not the Beit HaMikdash is corrupt if there's no Beit HaMikdash that might contain corruption anymore. The Beit HaMikdash is, and it's kind of obvious to say, but nonetheless, is such an overwhelmingly defining moment in Jewish history that it sweeps over and overwhelms everything else. Some groups basically cease to be or go off to become their own thing, like Christianity. And other groups, for one reason or another, start to recede into the background. But at the same time, a new movement begins to emerge. The rabbinic movement. The rabbis, who go on to start producing their essential texts. So how do we go? How do we go from Pharisees among a whole group of other sects to rabbis? I already said the Pharisees are the rabbis. But why do we go from one to the other? And something else important to just note, Chazal themselves are relatively hesitant to see themselves as Pharisees, which is an important point to just bear in mind. There are a very small number of sources, but that's basically it. Take a look at source number 7. It's a Mishnah in Demai, which is all about tithing. And I'm going to read the whole thing and then explain it. And this is the final source. So I know it's late. We're winding up to the end. Hamakabel alav liot ne'eman. If you accept upon yourself to become trustworthy. Ma'asa etchuhu ochel, you tithe whatever you eat. Ve'etchuhu mocher, what you sell. Ve'etchuhu lokech, what you buy. Ve'enom mit areach etzel am ha'aretz. And you can't be the guest of an am ha'aretz. Remember, Prushim separated themselves from the masses. Ostensibly given source number 6, they're cool inviting other people over, but won't necessarily go to other people's houses. Not much has changed. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, af hamit areach, eitzel am ha'aretz ne'eman. Even one who is the guest of an am ha'aretz can be considered trustworthy. Amrullah al atzmo eino ne'eman. He's not trustworthy in respect to himself. Keitzel yei ne'eman, how can he be trusted with others? This Mishnah here tells us very clearly the root of Pharisaic distinction, tithing, otherness. There's a great line in an article I was reading. It's not so much that a Pharisee, you know, might just be one random person in a crowd as much as the Pharisee would not be part of the crowd to begin with. They separate themselves. Then we get to the next Mishnah. Hamakabel alav. So this first one talked about becoming ne'eman. Then we get the next thing. Hamakabel alav liot chaver. If you want to become a chaver, eino mocher la'am ha'aretz, you can't sell things. And then we get basically a whole set of debates of what exactly it means to become a chaver, which is an extra level of stringency. We think chaver means friend because that's kind of what it means. But what a chaver is chaver is an official member of a chabura, of an association. Just like there are nowadays 1,000 associations ranging from small to big, some of which might have more intense requirements than others. Those existed in the Second Temple period too. And there was a chabura. It was small, of the people who were obsessed with ma'aser. And they had all of these various rules, as we've seen, and it kind of gauged and delineated their interactions with others. But to become a chaver required a certain level of things to join this association, to join this group. A perushi, and I'm going to stop saying the short soshi at this point, A prushi, a Pharisee, is essentially a member of this group, a member of this culture, a member of this very, very, very specific and small association. What happens after the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed? The location of this association moves, and the people in this association start to use a very generic term. It's the Hebrew, it's the Aramaic term for simply leader. But the people in charge of this association what we might use nowadays is there's a president of an association. So they used a slightly different term, a rav, a rabbah, a rabbi, a rabbi, a rabban. They started to use this term that means leader to speak of one another. And what they started to do was to crystallize and start to form far tighter the rules of their association. Their association, the rules of how they understood Judaism to be followed. And what this group of people ended up becoming were the Tanaim. These are the rabbis of the Mishnah. They were the member of this Chabura. They were the members of this association. That's how they started. It's really important to realize over the 200-year history of Tanaim, there are maybe 100 and something of them. If we're being ambitious in counting them, they were always very small. And they were an incredibly small group. But what they would go on to produce was Tanaitic literature, including the Mishnah. What they would go on to do was bring order and define Torah Sheba Al Peh to the extent that we understand it today, which is where we will begin discussing, what we will begin discussing next week. There is one final postscript, and I'll say this postscript while people can feel free to either mentally compose their questions then ask them, or alternatively type these questions. The question becomes, why do they cease using the term Pharisee to describe themselves? And the simple answer, hopefully we'll have time to talk about this more in the coming weeks, specifically to cease the obsession with sectarianism. A Pharisee is to, calling yourself a Pharisee is to mark yourself as an other, is to intentionally take on a very specific alienating term. Just like nowadays, there are a ton of terms you might choose to describe yourself on, with, which will alienate others. And then there are other terms you will use which are intentionally there to avoid being alienating. By using the generic term rabbi to describe their, you know, the members of their association, you also sweep under the rug all of this sectarian debate. You're no longer calling yourself a one thing versus another. And the second thing, just to add to this, which has been pointed out, which is an idea I really like, the reason the Mishnah is so obsessed with debate and contradictory opinions is very much to try to stave off any more sectarianism. If you legitimize multiple opinions automatically, it resists there being further splinters, which is exactly what the early rabbis were wanting to avoid when they kick-started their movement. So to summarize, there is a turning point between the era of Hillel and Shammai and those who would come later, the first rabbis. Ultimately, that's the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, which with it, you know, painting with a broad brush, ends most of the sectarian debates. The survivors of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the Pharisees, who belonged to their own small group, their own small association, their Chabura, which had very strict laws, which was very sensitive to things like Ma'aseh, things like Tuma and Tahara, things that extended the holiness of the Beit HaMikdash into their wider lives. Those Pharisees rebranded. They decided to take upon themselves a new name. They decided, and again, how much they actively did this versus we now ascribe to them, again, this term. But they go on to be the world's first rabbis, as TM, R in a circle, registered trademark rabbis. The birth of the rabbinic movement happens in the wake of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. But what we'll have to try and explain starting next week, and what we'll talk about, is where exactly Torah Sheba Al Peh fits within this. Because we're going to end this series understanding the Mishnah, which is kind of the first written text of Torah Sheba Al Peh, the oral law that we have. We've already seen some clear examples of oral law being lived throughout the Second Temple period. But what we're going to start off next week talking about is exactly how the Torah Sheba Al Peh, the oral law, took shape during this period and then was transformed into, ironically, a written text that would then be learned and studied from and explored in the generations that would follow.